Talk given Saturday, 1st July, 1972. In all the conventional approaches in the name of religion to the body, we find an attitude of depreciation of the body. The body is a temptation, a snare, a barb, and an imposthume, as we find in the Buddhist writings, for instance. That is one side of the picture. And religious texts also talk of the body as the temple of the Most High, and that the dweller in the body, if you take the Upanishadic writings, the Skanda Upanishad for instance, the dweller in the body is no other than Shiva. Shiva, Sada Shiva, Shiva the ever auspicious one. You find in the New Testament also, know ye not that ye are the temple of the Most High. So now, how do we understand these two contrary presentations of the body? We must look first into the root of this contrariness. Why is it that some have talked of the body in this deprecatory manner? Others have talked of it as the temple of the Most High. Is not this contrariness an expression of our own, incomplete perception of the split in our own awareness? And the mind is the instrument for perpetuating this contrariness. Because the mind functions mostly, in some people's case almost entirely, in ambivalent terms, in the terms of duality. Because it does so, it separates body on the one hand from mind, pure mind, spirit, soul on the other. No one can deny that the body is perishable. It suffers death. And in opposition to that, there is postulated something which is immortal, an essence of mind, or a spirit, or a soul. But obviously this is a postulate made out of ignorance, because nothing which is an entity can be immortal. Immortality characterizes totality, not the entity, the separate entity. So this contrariness in our own basic ideas lies at the root, so it seems to me, of these conflicting presentations. We all know from actual experience that it is because of the body we have so many desires, appetites, urges, whims, fancies, passions, and so on. And if they are frustrated, we suffer. If they are gratified, we may experience some pleasure at first, but inevitably suffering later on somehow or other, if it is only in the shape of disappointment, that they cannot be repeated in that particular form or whatever it is. So when a person who knows this as an ordinary, everyday fact of everyone's life turns to religion, to something deeper than this ephemeral passing show, he is conditioned by this knowledge which he has of the nature of the body and its experiences and so forth. And he naturally feels the body is an obstruction to the religious life. And he thinks of it only as an obstruction. And of course, in the usual ignorant way of one who lives in ambivalence, one tries to destroy the obstruction or at least push it aside. This is in my way, out it goes, or out it should go. And if it doesn't go of its own accord or by persuasive means, well, we must destroy it, break it up. So that is one, perhaps, one way in which this body as an obstruction to the religious life, this idea of the body as an obstruction to the religious life, comes into being. And unfortunately, it doesn't remain merely at the level of idea, it's put into practice by those who are earnest as far as living the religious life is concerned. There is considerable truth in the fact, in the statement, that the body is a barb. There is no sense at all, however, in the subsequent attitude to the fact that the body is obstructive to the religious life. This is what we must bear in mind very carefully. Consider how all our psychological process is dependent upon the bodily process. It's interwoven with it. There's the bodily pleasure-pain mechanism. There is the corresponding psychological I like, I dislike. And the conflict that is raised up thereby. There is no conflict in the actual physical mechanism as such. A stimulus, a sensation is either pleasant or it is unpleasant. Or, of course, it may be neutral, in which case there is no special psychological counterpart involved in it, apart from the fact that the psyche is quiet. But when it comes to the psychological part, the I like gives rise to attachment and the desire to repeat the I like. Where the body is concerned, physically, a stimulus comes from somewhere, well, it comes, and it's, we'll say, pleasant. The body itself has no power to work for the repetition of that stimulus. The body is a mechanism in this situation. But the psyche, which gets attached and therefore subject to a special desire, then produces the urge towards that sort of action which will repeat the stimulus, the physical stimulus. And so comes attachment and pleasure and all the rest of it, in that sense. And on the other hand, there is the dislike part. So there is a conflict. Now, go very deeply into this. And we can't do it in half an hour or something. We have to be constantly watchful and examine how all our psychological reactions are related to the body. There is not a single psychological reaction which is free of its actual physical, substantial nature. There is a physical part to it. If there were no physical part, there'd be no psychological part. You may ask why. Why can't there be an independent psychological part? Unless there were some physical source, like the brain, for instance, an impression would not register. And if an impression doesn't register physically, then there is no psychological reaction. The psychological reaction is observed by us as if it followed the physical impression. Actually, the two take place simultaneously, because the event is a whole event involving a psychophysical experiencing in the moment. The brain takes time acting through a memory process to reconstruct and say, oh, I felt this, or I went through this afterwards. Isn't that so? Now, if say, certain nerves or brain cells or both, for some reason or other, had ceased to function in a certain way, or just never functioned at all in a certain way, right from birth, whatsoever belongs to that type of stimulus would not register on that person at all. He'd be insensitive. And if he's insensitive, well, that's the end of the story, so to say. And if it doesn't register, obviously he can't react. Can't react unless there is an action which has come to you, upon you. So you see, everything that we go through in the mind, in our feelings and our thoughts, invariably has its physical counterpart. I'm using the word physical in the old-fashioned sense of the material. So now, when we have what we may call evil states of mind, it implies also an evil state of body. Have we ever thought of this? Looked into it, really looked into it. And vice versa. If there is an evil state of body, an ill state of body, there is also tied up with it an ill state of mind. You see, illness is a body-mind phenomenon. It's neither purely physical nor purely psychological, as if the two were completely separate. If one asks the question, which came first, it seems to me that the question is a wrong question. The good old egg and the chicken story. How can there be a first and a second involved in that which is a single whole? We are a psychophysical organism. It is quite likely that the term psychophysical is a very limited term. Perhaps we are psychophysical, spiritual, goodness knows what not else, single organism. So, it is as if on all planes, however many there may be, everything happens simultaneously. So now, if any illness, any ill state, is a whole ill state as such, the body, as we have been accustomed to regard it, must now be regarded in quite a different way. The physical is the whole thing, if we take the real meaning of the word physical, from physis, nature. It is the natural thing, the physical thing, and nature is whole. It is not split up into this, that, and the other. The splitting up takes place through the activity of our analytical mind. And it has to take place, this splitting has to take place, this analysis has to take place, because that is how this particular machine, the senses and the discursive thought consequent thereon, function. That is how the machine functions. The machine is like a prism which, when white light, ordinary light falls on it, splits it up into the colors of the spectrum, and you see the spectrum. We are at the stage where we see only the spectrum. You see, we are confined to the spectrum. Now, if we and that means that the mind in us, or rather that which so functions in us living beings that we call it mind, that's what I mean, that the mind in us functions only in separate bits, instead of as a single unified whole. It functions with either the sight consciousness predominant, or the hearing consciousness, or the touch consciousness, or the discursive thought process consciousness. That is to say, the talking process. Because the naming process is indispensable for the recognizing of the sense impressions. You may experience the sense impression, any sense impression, but if you don't name it, you can't consider it in the usual way. And all this is done by the logical talking process inside. This is our difficulty. So we are confined to this spectrum aspect only. But as and when, through what we commonly call the religious discipline, or the discipline of living the holy life, we awake to the fact of this splitting up by the mind, and we learn to become quiet to become silent, then the predominance of any sense consciousness disappears. The mind becomes a whole, and instead of the spectrum, it's now the white light, the whole fact, the whole truth, as far as man can ever realize the whole truth. When this happens, body, mind, soul, spirit, to use any words you like, are all one single reality, a living whole. It is this which is so difficult. First, even to see and to understand intellectually, and then so to live that it is an ordinary fact of our everyday life, that we just live in terms of a whole consciousness instead of a subdued, analytical, constrained consciousness. If and when one is in that state of wholeness, then the body certainly is the temple of the Most High. There is no conflict. What does this mean in terms of everyday experience? Pleasure, pain, difficulty, what the world calls success, failure, ease, disease, they all come and go. But this awareness of wholeness remains whole awareness. Although you may be in a situation of great pleasure and comfort, or in a situation of great pain and discomfort, whatever the situation may be. Naturally, the question will arise in your mind, but you said that illness is a whole phenomenon of body and mind. So how can you have an awareness which is pure and whole and transcendent, if you like, and still go through pain and discomfort on the one hand, or of pleasure and ease on the other hand? The living organism is a repository, if you like. Of course, it's a bad word, because it immediately makes the organism the container and the other thing the contained. But let us use that word for the moment. It's the repository of awareness, which is not my awareness or consciousness, but is a total thing. It's a universal thing, the infinite. The finite, funnily enough, looked at that way, is the container of the infinite instead of the other way around. A container in this context and in this sense is an obstructor. I mean, fancy a box trying to contain the whole universe. The box is the obstructor. This body is the box. And this totality of consciousness is that which it holds. Insofar as it holds, one has only partial vision, partial understanding. But when one awakes to the fact of the partiality is out. One will never know the infinite. But the infinite is realized through this finite. And in that is the wellness, the healthy state of the entire organism. The organism need not be free of actual pain, or dis-ease, as ordinarily understood, and yet be a whole organism. All this sounds very contradictory, doesn't it? Logically contradictory. It is a very difficult subject, actually, this subject of the body. But one has to be very patient and begin to see sense out of all the what appears to be nonsense. In practice, in actual practice, when one is mindful of the different reactions that come up, one is mindful of the whole psychological process. One can see it not only as a psychological process, but as a psychophysical process. Then one becomes aware. One really wakes up to the immense influence that the body exercises over the psychological process. Everything can be related to the body. So you can take both statements and see the truth of both of them, although they are contradictory statements. When one understands the process, Shiva is present. As long as one doesn't understand, and one struggles as a separate entity with what is going on in the mind, then one is in the worldly state. What is of real importance then? Where the state of the, let us use the word body in the conventional sense. What is of real importance then in connection with one's bodily state? Is it not that one shall learn constantly from the bodily state? Instead of trying to bring the body to a particular desirable state, a favorable state, a happy state. Because if one is really learning the process of healing, making whole, goes on unimpeded, doesn't it? It is because we are not learning in the real sense that the disharmonious condition continues to prevail. If I am afflicted in some way, that is to say, if I am, say, bodily afflicted in some way, and if the mind can remain silent, but fully attentive, alert, with no self-interest involved in it, no self-center to which all that attentiveness is directed ultimately. If that can go on, then real learning takes place. And real learning means the freeing of consciousness from all the delusions, the illusions, the veils that are around it. This is the point. It's not that we have learnt a particular lesson in the everyday, ordinary sense of the word, but consciousness becomes freed. Consciousness is what is bound. You will find Krishnamurti talking about these things in his modern way. You will find it way back in the Upanishads. In the Sarvasara Upanishad, what I've been trying to say now is quite positively stated. But of course, that's only one sentence. And to understand the full significance of that sentence literally takes years, because I read this in the Sarvasara Upanishad in 1941 or so. And it's only now that I feel that I'm really beginning to get at what it is all about. What is said there is this. The question is asked, what is bondage? And the answer is, identifying the Atma with the body is bondage. Identifying the Atma with the body is bondage. And yet there are other Upanishads, a great many of them, major ones, important ones, which will say that the Atma is everything, is the totality. Now you see, when you get a single sentence like that, one is naturally perplexed. Here are two quite contradictory statements. If the Atma is everything, one does not need to take the trouble to identify Atma with the body. It is so, all right. But the word Atma is only a word with me until the Atma is realized. And the word, as it remains with me, is defined by me as an entity, a something, which is quite wrong. When you yourself, utterly silent, still, purified, with the mind quite empty, transparent, are in complete communion, in the state of complete communion, it is that which is meant by the word Atma. The Varaha Upanishad gives a clue to this, you see. So you see, this is the state of the infinite. You get it in the Chandogya Upanishad too, in certain forms. This is the state which is the Atma. One is aware of the body as a particular finite object. It is not the all-full, the infinite, the birthless, the sorrowless, hungerless, thirstless, and deathless. So if one identifies it in the ordinary intellectual way, identifies the Atma with the body, one is in the state of bondage. Because obviously this is not. You read that discourse of the Buddha, where Magandhya talks with the Buddha And the Buddha talks of health and nirvana. And Magandhya says, ah, yes, I quite agree with you. This is health. This is nirvana. Stroking his body. He's in a happy state. He's well, physically. So he says it. And the Buddha points out the flaw in his statement. Because Magandhya not being one in whom nirvana was realized, identified nirvana with what is experienced in the ordinary way as bodily well-being. And the Buddha points out how this very body is the source of all the ill states of the mind. Consider its constitution, which gives rise to the different urges, which gives rise to the phenomena of self-protectiveness, of possessiveness, of fear, of violence, antagonism, destructive activity, and so forth. The body gives rise to all that as such. Doesn't it? Don't try to sort of follow the abstract statement as I make it. But try and relate it to the concrete reality of our everyday experience. I myself, for example, during these 5 months, have been very watchful over all the psychological process involved in this business of the house, for instance. The possessiveness, the fear, if this goes, what will happen, etc., etc., etc. You see? But this is all related to the fact that there is this physical body, isn't it? And it is from here that the mental outlook emerges. If I haven't a roof over my head, if I can't get my next meal, if my bank balance is unbalanced, etc., etc. You see, the whole complex of fear, of conflict, and all the rest of it emerges. So in that sense, the body is the obstruction. What we call the natural urge, the instinctive urge to protect it, to keep it safe, is in actual fact, if you go sufficiently deeply, antisocial. It is against the life process. If, on the other hand, one becomes careless, that is also antisocial and against the life process. And both these have their roots in grasping and the conflict which all grasping raises up. When one is freed of the grasping, then one observes and learns not from the point of view of a self which is learning, but the process of learning goes on, which means the liberating of the consciousness itself. And it is this liberation which is talked of when the Upanishads use the word moksha, when the Buddha uses the word vimutti, and so forth. And this is unquestionably right at the heart of the living of the religious life, the holy life. When one has become free of grasping, together with its associated possessiveness, fear, also with ambition, violence, hate, and so forth, when one has become free of all that, then what happens? This very body, which was the source of all these conflicts and misery and so forth, has been converted into the temple of the Most High. It is through this very body, then, that the whole truth and marvel and beauty, which is enshrined in the word man, shines forth. Again, do remember, this does not mean that you or I, as we are now, can say, oh, therefore, then, the body ought to be thus, thus, and thus. No. No ought can be imposed upon the body. Because you see, this ought is always a limited conception. If I impose a limited conception upon the organism, in any shape or form, there is no freedom. And if there is no freedom, then this liberated state of one's awareness is lost. Nirvana is not there. Then, you know, this is not at all easy. And I know that I have not presented it with clarity, with lucidity. It's a very difficult subject, and it's only recently that it is sort of coming to light in my own awareness. But one can see, one can sense these sort of possibilities. One of the great aspects of yoga is precisely this: the transformation of what we commonly call body from an obstructor to transcendent reality into the full manifester of transcendent reality. This is yoga. Nothing is left out. It is not confined to the mind, to the heart, to the feelings, to the aspirations, to what we are commonly pleased to call, really to miscall, the spiritual side of us. It is the whole thing. This is the whole thing. We don't know its wholeness. We know it only as bones, flesh, blood, etc. But it is not just bones, flesh, blood, etc. It is the whole reality. The natural thing, the physical thing. And the transformation of this into being the manifester instead of the obstructor of transcendent reality means fundamentally, and this we can put in intellectual terms, means fundamentally that all self-orientation is completely out. There is no self-center, there is no selfness. If there is no self-center, no selfness, this, the finite, is in completely harmonious relationship within the infinite. This is yoga, in the grand sense. This is the meaning of all this symbolical presentation in terms of Kundalini yoga, the chakras and so forth. Because here they say Shiva resides. He actually does reside here. But for the mass of human beings through the centuries and through the ages, the Lord is unrecognized by us. In our very being, we just don't know that the Lord is there. So to say. I'm talking in localized terms as if it was located there, but this is a symbolical way of talking. It's the story of the transformation of your own awareness, your own consciousness. But note very carefully the root of the matter, no selfness. You can't convert the infinite into an object of possession. If one dispossesses oneself, then the infinite takes up you, the finite, and manifests its own infinity through you, the finite. And this is the magic. People have always associated magic with yoga. But this is the magic, isn't it? The impossible has happened, so to say. And all the limitations in where understanding this is concerned, which lie in the intellect, the limited intellect, all those disappear. Why? Because that monkey, the intellect, has stopped jumping. Meditate on this quite a lot, the body. Neither decry it nor exalt it. Do not let it confine consciousness. And you can save yourself from the confinement if the examination, the meditation, is truly pure examination, pure meditation. Not trying to get a result. That is all. This trying to get a result is due to the body whilst we are unenlightened. Because the body, the bodily process, is always working towards an aim, an end, a result. The perpetuation of its own life. All the bodily processes are directed towards that end. Isn't that so? And the psychological counterpart is, I shall gain this, that, or the other if I think, feel, and act in this, that, and the other manner. So the whole of life gets self-oriented. That is where the difficulty comes. So meditate on the body quite a lot. Quite a lot, constantly. Be aware of what the body is doing, how it is going through its ordinary everyday processes. Look at the tedious detail with which the Buddha talks of this in the famous discourse to Rahula, for instance, on mindfulness with regard to the body. If you twiddle your thumbs, be very aware that you are twiddling your thumbs. But not in that sort of dead, photographic, cinematographic way in which the unintelligent devotee is aware, I'm twiddling my thumbs, I'm twiddling my thumbs, I'm twiddling my thumbs. I've stopped twiddling my thumbs. I've stopped twiddling my thumbs. That's stupid. No. The attentiveness, the mindfulness, the awareness has to be a whole awareness. This is only a partial awareness. If I have my eyes open, I can see, but I know that I'm twiddling my thumbs because of my muscular sense, isn't it? Feeling, my touch sense. There's only one sense functioning there. And that is pretty senseless to let just one sense function. Let all the senses function. Let the whole consciousness be awake to thumb twiddling. And see what happens. Something quite different. You will learn then. Again, when one observes emotional states or feeling states, as they are called in the Buddhist presentation, they very rarely talk of emotion as such as we talk of it. But they talk of feelings, the feeling state. There is this feeling present. But that is, well, I mean, any fool can know I'm feeling very happy or delighted or drunk or or feeling miserable or anxious or frightened. Anyone can know that. So what? That's nothing. You observe the feeling state, that this feeling is present. But the observation has to be attended with an awakened mind, a sensitive, intelligent mind, a living mind, not like a dead cinematographic film, you know, which merely the light rays act upon the film and there is the record, so to say, which you can display on the screen afterwards. Not like that. That is not mindfulness. That is not being aware. That is merely a sense function, not in full relationship, not in proper relationship with consciousness itself. You get it? Now, be aware of the body that way, and you will find that you are aware of your whole being. And you will be, and you will really know that the word body is a very poor representation in sound, in audible sound, of something which is extraordinarily full and rich and big. Body is like that. I've said sometimes nature is Mrs. God. I've also said nature is the body of God. Others also have said things just like that, that nature is the body of God. God meaning the absolute, the infinite, the totality, whatever you like. All right. So you see the significance of body. If body stands for nature, the whole of manifestation, which of we are ignorant of the greater part of manifestation, to awake to the significance of body, that means you awake to the significance and meaning of the totality all the time. And in this is liberation, and in this is living the religious life. Because unless there is that awakeness, there cannot be right response. There cannot be right sensitivity. Then evil things get done. But awake, and we cease to be producers of evil. So meditate on the body.